Rich Kimble here along with Carrie Haskell and Bruce Pratt in the house with us for another edition of Sports Lit 101. And we welcome another guest to the segment this week as we're joined on the phone by poet Michael Begnaw. Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Mike, it's Bruce. I shared with Rich the poems that you sent, and we would like to have you read some of them later. But one of the things we always like to talk about when the subject is baseball and literature is why baseball seems to be among the many sports the one that seems to be most conducive to poetry and fiction. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people have said baseball is the most poetic of sports, and I think, you know, that even comes up on the Ken Burns series. I got to agree with Ken Burns on that. I don't know, you know, maybe one of the reasons is that it's much more cerebral. You know, there's a lot of time in between, specific plays and actions where you're thinking about various possibilities, various outcomes, and there's a lot of time for the mind to unwind itself. There's also a lot of nostalgia attached to baseball, as I think we all probably know as well. I think the combination of just the nature of the sport itself, the nostalgia, the mythology, just kind of lends itself to poetry.
Michael, a lot of your poems center on the New York Mets. I don't want to bring any pain to you here, but is there anything poetic about this season's edition of the Mets?
There is. I mean, I think it would almost be not poetic, you know, if it was all about winning. You know, probably like the Yankees are probably the least poetic of baseball teams, you know, I got to say. If poetry and literature is about the human condition, then most of the time, you know, we're not winning them all like the Yankees.
Well, as a Yankees fan, we're not winning them all at the moment either.
Historically speaking, I guess I should say.
2018 being the reverse of the 1978 massacre. One of the other things, though, is that you connect with baseball that you could not have experienced. I mean, Josh Gibson was too old for you to have seen.
Yeah.
There is a romance about baseball that connects us with the past of players we didn't know. How did that sort of first come to you as this topic to explore poetically?
Well, you mentioned Josh Gibson, the legendary player for the Pittsburgh Homestead Grays and the Pittsburgh Crawfords. And I got interested in him because I was living in Pittsburgh. And, I've read August Wilson's play Fences, great play. And living in Pittsburgh, for example, there's just still a lot of respect for its baseball history, including its Negro Leagues history. A lot of people know about players like Josh Gibson in Pittsburgh, and he's really just such a fascinating figure. As you mentioned, way too far back in time for me to have seen him play personally, but that aura around him, I think, still survives.
You know, I was wondering if you could read at the grave of Josh Gibson, because it seems to me this is, if William Blake had been around and was your age, this is the poem he would have written about him. Right? He would have made a connection to someone that he couldn't physically see, but could only imagine. Would that be all right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I actually did make a trip myself to the grave of Josh Gibson. He's buried in Pittsburgh and Allegheny Cemetery, just a very small stone, which I believe Willie Stargell actually spent the money to restore and to mark. I think previously it was unmarked. So, you know, around this time that I was becoming interested in Josh Gibson as a figure and as a great baseball player, I actually went there, and that's what sparked this poem or inspired this poem. So I'll read the poem. It's called At the Grave of Josh Gibson. On a slope of a hill, up a steep hill, buried slant, a flat stone, grass at the edge, grasshoppers scatter pollen grains on a pant leg, two fawns among the grounds, black dragonflies in the air, I am wearing my Gray's hat. We have come to pay homage and to smoke a bone and to say that he's there, or staggering out of a movie theater or in a joint in Homestead. All speech is in its own meter and can be scanned. The meter is possibly irregular. The body breaks down. In a fight at the Crawford Grill, two anapests and an iron, Crawfords get ill, a bloodied face or a dirty mitt, or wailing in your whale corner like some kind of assertion, a mask artist staggering out, a mask artist staggering out. Hill footpaths trod to the grill, and you know he's there with you now, wailing in your whale corner, and on the corner when veins get varicose. He's there in the narrative theater, in the park, on the diamond, at the plate. He's there in a Gray's uniform, holding a giant bat and two suitcases. He's there in your skull, bashing things.
I love that poem.
That's wonderful.
I had read it again this afternoon. I was also thinking that there's the Gray when you wrote about the Athletics. Now, Rich probably didn't tell you, but he's a bit of a baseball historian. He's the baseball guy here above everybody.
Okay.
And he was said to me, he took a look at that poem and said, I love this one. So I was wondering, could you read that and tell us a little bit about that one too?
Yeah, that one's a little older. I wrote that a number of years ago, just kind of thinking back on baseball history and sort of the lost teams. Of course, the Philadelphia Athletics, not really lost. They just moved to Kansas City and then Oakland. But this is a shorter one, kind of just going back and imagining, you know, Philadelphia's other team, the Philadelphia Athletics. Gus Zernial, Bobby Shantz, Joe Astroff, not to mention Lefty Grove, Jimmy Fox, and Home Run Baker. Not P for Philadelphia, but A for Athletics. The blue caps and a blue A emblazoned on white jerseys. Toiling in Connie Mack Stadium, 21st and Lehigh, the white elephants soon to be cast adrift.
Love that. And one of the great logos, forgotten logos and mascots in the history of pro sports, those white elephants of the A's.
Yeah, right. I know. I think the Oakland Athletics have brought that back. But to me, for some reason, it looks a little better in blue and white.
Absolutely. I love that poem.
When you think about how Shea Stadium was once new, the Vet in Philly was once new. There were these ballparks that were built inexpensively. They had plastic seats. And now baseball has become gone back to everybody trying to be a bigger version of Fenway or Camden Yards. How is that when you go to a game, and I imagine you go to Royals games, when you go to games, how is that different for you? Does it make you yearn for minor league baseball the way it does to me?
I actually live in Indianapolis right now.
Oh, that's why I'm sorry. I didn't mean the Royals.
But you know, I was in Kansas City and in the state of Kansas for the recent Sport Literature Association conference. But Indianapolis only has minor league baseball, the Indianapolis AAA team. And used to have, there were a couple of Negro League teams here in Indianapolis, the ABCs, and then later the Clowns. I have to say I like the newer Major League stadiums that are, you know, trying to be unique and kind of trying to hark back to the old stadiums. When I grew up, I was a kid in the 70s and 80s, and those sort of cookie-cutter stadiums like Veterans Stadium and even Shea were around, so, you know, that was kind of normal to me. But when we started going the Camden Yards route and trying to make them a little more individual in character, I thought that was great.
Your poem on Shea Stadium, the Shea Stadium elegy, that was not one of the more beautiful stadiums ever built in professional baseball history, and yet for the people who went there, such a bond with that stadium and that team.
Yeah, and I would say that at the very least, Shea Stadium had real grass as opposed to Stadium in Three Rivers.
Would you be willing to read your poem about Dwight Gooden?
Absolutely, yeah. So when I was a teenager in the 80s, Dwight Gooden, who was around my age, we're just separated by about a year, was kind of my latter-day baseball hero. And so I've written this poem. It's called Poem for Dwight Gooden. I guess I should say one thing about baseball poetry that I've noticed is there often tends to be a lot of mythologizing and kind of, you know, a lot of hero worship. And I guess in a way I'm kind of trying to avoid this a little bit in this poem for Dwight Gooden, which goes like this. Strikeout pitcher, too strong, hurling pills across the plate, herald of 1986 triumph. Still elevated and taking the cure at Smithers and strolling in from the bullpen in 89 to the ovation of the crowd, whose fastball clocked at 100, whose fastball broke a catcher's finger bone, and number 16 will one day adorn the outfield fence of Shea. Poor Dwight to be the Mets' redeemer and mystical hero. Who are they we choose as ours? Dwight Gooden, my baseball cards, my 1990 dream where Dwight appeared and strode the mezzanine of Shea, assuring me the Mets would win the pennant. Wanted to believe that year, but it was just a dream. My baseball cards' value evaporating like a plume of white in the upper air. Poor Dwight to be Dr. K, solar successor to Seaver, and he has only Dwight to Nash.
Oh, man, that is terrific.
That's very, very good poem. Mike, I really appreciate you joining us and appreciate you taking time. I had a great time talking to you at SLA, and I hope I will see you there again.
No doubt you will.
Thank you so much for being with us, Michael. We appreciate it.
Oh, all right. Thanks again for having me. I really appreciate it, too.
That's Michael Begnall here on Downtown, and that's some great stuff.
Yeah, he's very, very good and very... You know, as I always say about Sports Lit, most of the people there are college professors, but they don't act like them. And it's a very low key, very fun kind of thing. It was the first time I had met him, and he was just a delight to hear read. Really, really.
Well, I want to ask you, Bruce. Now you've written plays, you've written short stories, you've written poetry. What's the most difficult challenge in creating poetry?
You know, I think it's to remember that a poem is more of a snapshot than it is a mural or a series of pictures, and that you need to capture basically one thing that becomes something else. And I find poetry is the most difficult of all the things that I do. Well, I mean, a novel is difficult because it takes an incredible amount of time. But to get a poem just right, I have a poem that I finally think I have just right, and I looked at the date on when I first wrote it. 1977.
Wow.
And I couldn't quite get what I wanted to get. And, you know, I've had other poems that it basically sort of spilled out of themselves. And you know, the first time I sent them out, somebody said, okay, we'll publish it. But I think that the hardest thing is to just keep focused on where we talk about something triggers it, and then something is generated. Following the trigger where it wants to take you rather than trying to force it somewhere it doesn't belong. But yeah, poetry is really hard, I find.
Sports Lit 101 every Wednesday here. What's coming up next week on the segment?
Next week we will talk to Brian Daldorf. Now, you and I talked a little bit about his book Ice Age. The poem is very short, many short poems. He's originally from Great Britain. He teaches at the University of Kansas. But his dad died of Alzheimer's, and while he was researching Alzheimer's, he also discovered that it has plagued famous English soccer players, including an abnormal number of their last World Cup winners. And he thinks that people thought once the balls weren't leather and heavy with rain, that heading them wouldn't be a problem. And then he figured out that you might, if you had a long soccer career, you might head the ball over 600 times. That's 600 subconcussive hits. There are NFL linemen that ain't going to have that many. And it's really, the poems are really interesting. And Brian's research is really interesting. So we're going to talk about both. And then the week after that, we will have Joe Schrag on, who we talked about his book on the Kansas relays, and we'll talk about that, and especially the 72 relays when John Musgrave led the Vietnam Veterans Against the War in a very peaceful, simpatico protest. I think the week after that, I don't know. But anyway, for the next couple of weeks, I'm trying to get Robert Turpin on, who wrote about the history of marketing bicycles, because he can do a much better job than I did explaining why it's so fascinating.
Outstanding.
So we're working on it.
Great. That's some of what's ahead here on Sports Live 101.